Hi, everyone, and welcome to Literary Loitering, the geek show's dedicated arts, books, culture, theatre, stage, screen, musicals even, podcast. My name's Rob, and joining me today are Andrew.
Why, hello.
And Mick. And Graham.
One job.
And Graham.
Hello.
Do you know what it is? It's four panel.
It's it started already. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Yes. Just with that one simple sexually charged introduction, I've already thrown the podcast into chaos.
Imagine how we're going to feel after the first news story.
Which shall we just get on with?
Yes.
Yes.
Because it's that time of the year again, everyone.
Yay!
It's the Bad Sex Awards.
Better than Christmas.
Well, certainly sexier.
Hmm, of course.
It's almost as sexy as my microphone dropping down because I haven't secured it enough.
I'm not going to say anything about flaccidness or anything like that.
Oh, no, Rob. There's no room for flaccidness here. Quite the opposite.
Is there some rock-hard dramatic reading that you're about to be doing?
Oh, my, yes. Now, this is, of course, the shortlist as published in The Guardian.
Yeah.
But here's a wacky thing. I'm going to be reading it in reverse order.
Ooh.
Because that way we are saving what, in my opinion, is the best for last.
Okay.
So, without further ado, here comes our first entry from Here Comes Trouble by Simon Rowe. A clothed body is always human or human-like. A naked body always animal or animal-like. Only at close quarters is the full extent of a body's wildness revealed, like when a bird gets trapped inside a house. One is moved to not an entirely human thinking then. One goes towards its animalness.
I have had a bird stuck in my house before, and I did not find anything seemingly erotic about the experience.
Yeah.
I also had a bird trapped in my house once, but that restraining order means I can't talk about it.
I'm confused by one thing. When it's clothed, it's human, and when it's unclothed, it's animal.
Yeah, because I don't know if you're familiar with the plot of this novel, but it turns out that the female lead is just a load of cats stuffed in a jumper.
Well, my main question is it some weird thing that happens whenever the characters take a shower then? Or do they shower fully clothed?
Someone's finally written an entire book about that one meme about I'm sorry, Miss Jackson. I am four eels. Sorry that I made your daughter cry, but I am several fish and not a guy.
Oh, I forgot about that.
This is already brilliant.
Yeah.
It's only going to get better. Entry number two is from War Cry by Wilbur Smith with David Churchill.
Wilbur Smith, there's a blast from the school reading library.
Yes.
I'm going to have you now, Leon said. He led her back up the beach to where the sand was dry. Then he took off his coat, placed it on the ground, and she lay down upon it. Christ, he muttered, placing himself on top of her. It's bloody cold. I might get frostbite on my cock. She gave a low, purring laugh. Silly man, why don't you put it somewhere? Hot.
This is why he normally writes about shooting tigers and stuff like that.
Oh, but Wilbur, that's not how you write sex, said Mr. Ed.
Look, I don't know. I think certainly of all the ones here, Wilbur Smith is the most practically minded author.
As Sue Townsend wrote in one of the Adrian Mole books, you know, you can say what you want about Wilbur Smith as an author, but would Franz Kafka know what sort of rifle to use to shoot a bull elephant at 50 paces? Of course he wouldn't.
Exactly.
Well, because the rifle would transform into some kind of winged serpent that would then fly off into space.
He's got a point.
Right, so this next one, I'm going to put out a warning, is a bit not safe for work. You know, unlike all the other ones we've been doing. Yeah.
Well, the other ones could use any language they wanted, and their sheer rubbishness would act as a sort of prophylactic.
This is true, but now get ready for The Future Won't Be Long by Jarrett Kobeck. Memories of these previous encounters became distant, remote, erased once I got down to brass tacks with John DeLee. With John, it was communication, a dialogue between two bodies, electric impulses transmitted over wires of flesh and bone. Words one cannot speak, words that can only be heard. Skin that became skin anew. We made love and we had sex. And we had sex and we made love. But reader, again, I implore you, mistake me not. I am not your Pollyanna. I am not your sweet princess. We f***ed. Then there's dropping the F-bomb, and then there's just carpet bombing.
Yes!
Isn't that what he did in the scene?
It's been so long since I've read something that had the narrator say, but reader. I think, like, the last time was probably reading a child's adventure story about a kid who becomes a pirate or something like that.
Oh, well, Graham. That's possibly the perfect lead-in to
As
a God Might Be by Neil Griffiths. Looking down, she unbuckled his belt. We're grown-ups. Perhaps he wasn't quite in that moment, because he thought of Kierkegaard and Socrates.
What?
If there wasn't great wisdom gained by high lust, by love, its consummation, the aesthetics of all this, then you were doing it wrong. Kiss me again.
Why would you think of Kierkegaard or Socrates in that moment?
I think this is the new lie back and think of England.
Yes. It sounds like it's written by a 13-year-old boy who was trying rather too hard to prove that he's a big adult now.
Oh, you mean Zack Snyder when he thought of a sucker punch?
Yes, yeah, basically.
It's what? Feminist, goddammit.
It's, all of these upskirt shots are deeply ironic. I'm looking up a list of Kierkegaard quotes on the internet because I'm a grown-up. To try and find out what quote could have been running through his mind at this point. I think it might be, do not forget to love yourself.
Are you sure it wasn't, it's bloody cold, I might get frostbite on my cock?
No, that was Heidegger.
Shall we have the next one?
Yes.
Yes, please.
So, this is Mother of Darkness by Venetia Welby.
Oh, this sounds edgy.
Oh, 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 oh. There are many edges to this one. Light filters in from the ravaging streaks of dawn. It splits into fragments of every hue. The world has hidden as it streaks the prism of their shelter. Terror's eyes expand and reflect, crystal orbs of time and space. She moans in colours as she pushes the white dress away, and beyond the angelic flesh, luminescent against the damp, mossy bed.
What? Why are they having sex on a load of moss?
No, I just think the bed hasn't been cleaned for a long time.
They really should have spent a bit extra to get a premiere in.
No, because then they end up with a Lenny Henry watching.
Would still have been more arousing than this. I'm fascinated by the mechanics of pushing a dress aside. I've never managed to remove clothes solely by pushing.
I'm fascinated by the fact that apparently one of them is a light bulb.
Yes, containing all of time and space in her eyes.
Yes.
I mean, that's the question. Does each eye contain time and space, or does she have, like, the space eye and the time eye? And presumably the other Infinity Gems somewhere. This is actually Marvel's prequel for Infinity War.
The Infinity Vajazzle. It is the Mad Sex Awards, so it would be, wouldn't it?
Would watch if Kate Blanchett was playing Hela again.
Oh,
so we've got two left.
Oh, it's so exciting.
This one is The Destroyers by Christopher Bolan. On the stone perch in the hot mountain air, we grapple with our clothing, which in the darkness becomes as complicated as mountaineering gear. Her black shirt around her neck, mine unbuttoned, our shorts and underwear slid to our ankles. We seem to be moving at avalanche speed, and also, unfortunately, with avalanche precision.
What?
Our sexing seems to have caused massive loss of life. We have derailed the Orient Express with the force of our sex.
I'm just wondering about precision avalanches. Is that a new super weapon that someone came up with that they didn't tell us about? We can make an avalanche that kills this one person right here in the middle of this city. Like,
is this the exciting sequel to Chip Zdarsky and Matt Fraction's Sex Criminals?
Possibly.
Instead of stopping time, they now cause very precise avalanches.
Yes.
There is that movie, isn't there, where Kate Winslet and Idris Elba fall in love after being stranded on a mountain after a plane crash, which to my mind
is not...
Wait, is
this what Cold Mountain is about?
It's not the most romantic set of images. I mean, like Will Smith, I'm worried about getting frostbite on my cock.
But no, it's okay, Grim, because they control the snow.
Oh, right, that makes sense now you put it like that.
So the sex pushes the snow away, like a woman pushing off a dress.
Yes.
So, hang on, are you saying that when they're actually having sex, they're basically transformed into a snowplow?
Yeah, you could, like, put them on the front of a train. Then it would have clear passage through the Alps as long as they kept sexing.
Hold on, I've just got my pitch for Speed 3.
Or it's either that or they definitely need more lube because the friction is melting everything. Oh.
Many of these seem quite poorly written to me. I know that's a bit of a hot take, but...
Well, don't worry, because we've got one really well-written one, because it's from The Seventh Function of Language by Lauren Binet.
Oh, a French intellectual. This'll be extra good.
He puts his hands on Bianca's shoulders and slips off her loca top. Suddenly, inspired, he whispers into her ear, as if to himself, I desire the landscape that is enveloped in this woman, a landscape I do not know, but that I can feel. And until I have unfolded that landscape, I will not be happy. Bianca shivers with pleasure. Simon whispers to her with an authority that he has never felt before, let's construct an assemblage.
Lament Binet's sexy cartography, ladies and gentlemen.
There's a landscape somewhere in this, and all I kept thinking when you were talking about it was the great landscape painters like Constable. As soon as I went there, so hang on, there's a police officer hiding somewhere inside this woman.
My mind was taken to landscape gardening, and I think you can probably fill in the rest from there.
Yes, that's some capability there.
I just hope Simon's properly budgeted the costs of building this assemblage.
What sort of assemblage is it?
Oh my god!
Is it like an Airfix kit?
No, I know what it is. I know what it is. I know what it is. When I was a kid, there was a stop motion animation on where they had a machine that could make everything. It was an assemblage machine called Bertha.
What?
And this must be the prequel.
This is how Bertha got made.
Yes.
I would like to point out, I got sent this list of quotes whilst downstairs with my family. And after reading that first one, I had to step out and take a moment.
My favourite telling detail in it is where he says, I whispered in her ear, as though to myself. It's like that says quite a lot about Lauren Binet, doesn't it? Like, if you said, I whispered, I would assume you were whispering to someone else.
Yeah.
But to him, all communication must be self-directed. It's like he goes through life saying, so I started talking to her, you know, like you would talk to yourself, but this time it was to another person. Has anyone done that before? Am I a pioneer?
No, I'd say more a narcissist. Yes. It's quite narcissistic, that kind of behaviour.
I think I worry about the kind of man who walks around whispering to himself, I desire the landscape that is inside this woman.
I must unfold it. I'm just wondering, where has that woman hidden that landscape and where did she steal it from?
Terrible case of landscape theft all over northern France this year, of course. We shouldn't make light of that.
It's either that or there's been some landscape gardening going on.
Yes, maybe. But just imagine Laurent Binet walking through the streets of this town going, make an assemblage. Let's make an assemblage. Make an assemblage.
Hey. We don't make assemblages like some backwater hick, Graham. We construct them.
My apologies.
If they're constructing an assemblage, are they also, like, taking a register as well? Or have I combined two things that are totally different?
I'm just thinking about Rowan Atkinson now. Plectrum.
Assemblage.
Anubis.
Actually, I'd love to hear him say that.
Yes, that's a trailer for later on in the show, listeners. We shouldn't get bogged down in that.
Yes.
That's amazing. Usual high standard, do we think?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think Let's Construct an Assemblage might be my new sexual rollercoaster of excitement.
It's only a shame that Morrissey is busy with his second career at the moment, because I'd love to see him return to defend his title.
You never know. Maybe the rollercoaster was the assemblage they constructed.
The mental images we're creating is sort of like M.C. Escher drawing for Penthouse.
Oh, I hear you for putting that in my head.
Like it could get worse than a man unbuttoning his pants and just like a crane popping out.
Oh no, but when the pants are unbuttoned, you must think of Socrates.
Yes. Oh, it's getting quite hot in here. I'll just push my jumper off. It's not moving. I'm going to have to use fingers of some description.
Oh.
Shall we do an interview story? Can anything live up to that?
I don't know. I'm going for this week.
Yes.
I'm just going to call in the corner and have a little cry.
Yeah.
Shall we talk about Papi Pariah?
Yes, let's go on.
So, Sean Penn, who is an actor with a capital A and a capital C and a T and an O and an R, has...
And been possibly a few more R's after it.
Yes. Can't forget the extra R's. It's full of R's. He released an audiobook last year, which passed me by, possibly because it was titled Bob Honey Who Just Do Stuff.
Sorry, what?
Bob Honey Who Just Do Stuff.
Is this like his version of Rita Sue and Bob 2 or something like that?
It could be. He claims...
It's an assemblage of words.
It can't be because I'm not completely aroused. He claims that Bob Honey Who Just Do Stuff was written by a man called Pappy Pariah, who he met in a bar in 1979, and then decades later got a package containing Pappy Pariah's memoir. And if that story sounds a bit suspicious to you, congratulations, you have a working brain, because of course Pappy Pariah does not exist. He is Sean Penn, and with the help of the publisher Atria Books, he will now turn Bob Honey Who Just Do Stuff into a full-length novel, which he describes as being about a man of many trades, sewage specialist, purveyor of tired pyrotechnics, contract killer for a mysterious government agency that pays him small bills.
Hang on, so he's a sewage specialist and a pyrotechnics engineer and a contract killer?
Yeah.
Oh my God, he's fulfilling all the bases. He's basically got himself a little industry there. So he goes out and kills somebody, dumps them into the sewage, lets them decompose, then uses parts of the sewage to manufacture fireworks.
That's good. Maybe you've worked out the plot.
Sewers, killing things, fireballs. It's a him! Mario!
Are you saying that Sean Penn is actually claiming that this is a novel by him to deflect attention from the fact that he has received the unauthorized autobiography of Super Mario?
Well, firstly, A, yes, obviously, Graham, it's all an elaborate double bluff. And B, his name isn't Super Mario. Gah! It's Mario Mario.
Yeah. And don't forget, he's so well known now, he's kind of a pariah, isn't he?
Yeah. And Pappy does have a sort of Italian-American look to it.
Well, maybe that's what Princess Peach calls him in private.
Maybe, yes. While they're having a little discussion on Kershigars.
He's thinking, oh, Socrates!
Yeah, well, we've cracked that mystery, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
Bob Honey can just do stuff.
Shall we move on?
Yes.
This one caught my attention. You know, competitive Scrabble?
Yeah.
Right. Now, apparently it's serious business, but I didn't really understand how serious until I saw this story. Apparently, you know the bag with the letters in? There is a correct way to hold that bag and draw your letters.
Right.
Because it's not actually a rule. It's more a kind of tradition, because apparently it's more difficult to cheat that way. But...
you have to hold it by your hip with kind of one hand hovering over it. And there's a pocket watch in the middle that's slowly ticking down.
No, unfortunately. Unfortunately,
and
no.
On the chime, you've got to pull out the letters and chuck them down.
Unfortunately, that's not the case. You have to hold the bag at shoulder height, and you know, so you can't look at the contents. But apparently, UK Scrabble champion Alan Simmons, who was also known as the Scrabble King, apparently, he hadn't been doing that, and he's been accused of not displaying an empty palm to his opponent before putting his hand in the bag, another serious etiquette breach that is apparently a red flag for potential cheating, because bad men might palm unwanted letters and swap them out while rummaging.
The Scrabble King sounds like the villain from the most disappointing series of True Detective ever.
Yeah, the thing is, these two breaches are actually quite small, but they're enough to earn him a 3-year ban from competitive Scrabble.
Oh my God, he's a Scrabble King in exile.
Yes.
Wandering the blasted heath like a King Lear of Scrabble.
Oh, we need
assembling his kind of team of true companions.
Yeah. All we need now
so that they can go back and fight the usurper Scrabble King who dethroned him.
Oh God, that Depeche Mode song was true. Words like violence break the silence. And the video fits as well.
This is a story of high drama that I feel sure will be the basis for a major HBO miniseries.
Yeah. I mean, the weird thing is, no one has actually said he cheated. It's just that he looked like he could have cheated. That's why they've banned him. that doesn't quite make sense to me. So that's like the police saying, well, he looked like he was going to commit a crime.
Yes.
I think that's called institutional racism, Rob.
So, yeah, that one caught me.
That's pretty good. Story that caught me, although it caught me for all of the wrong reasons. I was ready to get angry, listeners. I was getting ready to be proper ranch. Like that fella, you know, Pappy Pariah.
Oh, I thought his name was Raja.
Bodger and Raja. But then I found out that the story was actually something very different to what I thought it was. The headline in The Guardian reads, "Science fiction triggers poor reading, study finds." Now, this is not, it turns out, saying that science fiction readers are bad at reading. In a paper published in Scientific Study of Literature, the professors Chris Gavala, which I'm pretty sure is sort of from an Arthur C. Clarke novel already, and Dan Johnson, whose name is normal and I will not make a joke about, have found that when you give readers who do not identify as any particular genre connoisseurs science fiction text, they read it with less care than they would any other form of non-genre literature. Apparently, they prepared a sort of literary version of their sample text where a character goes into a diner and reads the town newspaper and finds that his letter to the editor has been published. And then they presented a science fiction version where he entered a Gallian space station and gets a news source from an android. And participants were asked questions like, how much can you put yourself in the shoes of the character in the story? How much did you get an impression of what the characters were feeling? And apparently, as soon as you say words like airlock and anti-gravity, people just sort of shut off a bit and start reading it more carelessly.
Okay. See, I made the same mistake as you when I first looked at this. I thought exactly the same thing you did. The thing that confuses me about this particular study, they're saying people show more carelessness, but did they do a control where they just gave them a normal book?
Yeah, they prepared two versions of the text, one of which had genre elements and one of which didn't.
Okay, but that's what I mean when I say control. It doesn't have genre elements, but how many genres did they actually go for? Did they actually do the same test with fantasy and with like historical fiction or Victorian stuff, period drama, that sort of thing?
Would be interesting. Yeah, apparently not. Although Gavala has said in the future he would like to test it with sort of genre signifiers, like he cites a cowboy hat or a sorcerer's wand.
Yeah, period drama is also a genre.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, I switch off at most of it.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain sort of... I mean, I like to think I'm a pretty open-minded reader, but there are certain sort of sentences and phrases that sort of take me out of the world of a novel, such as the phrase, by Martin Amis.
Oh, by Jane Austen.
Yeah, you know me so well.
But yeah, this is why I've kind of take issue with this, because... They've only focused on sci-fi and haven't done it with any other genre. So I think, okay, the results may be a little bit skewed, because if you're talking contemporary fiction, contemporary fiction is going to be relatable to people because it's about modern society and people. So
if I get this study right, people who don't like science fiction don't really pay attention when they're reading it.
Basically, yes. Yeah.
Right, good, thanks. Thanks, guys. Good job. Two thumbs up.
As science fiction readers, do you not feel even slightly smug at having a study which proves that everyone who doesn't like science fiction just isn't paying attention to it?
I want to say yes, but also it seems like they're doing the kind of science fiction where it's just, let's take a bunch of normal stuff and replace it with nonsense gobbledygook words.
Yeah, that's the other thing as well. It is basically saying, oh, people who watch EastEnders, they're not going to watch Star Wars or Star Trek. Sorry. Yeah, that's kind of, it's kind of not the case.
No, it's not the case, but in, I think in sort of visual mediums, science fiction is dominant. I mean, obviously in cinema now, it's a huge thing. But don't you find that in literature it is kind of ghettoized?
Yeah, I will say I think it still is kind of looked down upon as not a real show. I think even in film still, it's kind of considered sort of cheap entertainment.
That's it, except I suppose in film you do have a lot of the sort of, a lot of people like Stanley Kubrick and Andrei Tarkovsky who've worked in science fiction, and that makes it a bit harder to dismiss. Yeah. Whereas science fiction in literature only seems to be well reviewed once a big literary author announces that they're doing a science fiction book.
Yeah, and I think that's the sad part about it, is that there are lots of fantastic science fiction novels out there, old and new, but they just don't get publicised. They don't get any kind of press. They don't get any exposure in schools or anywhere like that. I know that my nephew, right, my nephew would love to read certain science fiction books in school, but instead he's having to read stuff like Enid Blyton, because Enid Blyton is relevant to him somehow.
Yes.
Sorry, I know she's popular.
Surely 1950s child detective adventurers is as much a nonsense fantasy world as, like, a galaxy in the future.
Well, all I know
to children
is,
like that.
All I know is that Enid Blyton books would be much better with lightsabers and magic.
Yes. Also, a lot of the Famous Five and other books like that are about kids who just sort of go off into the wilderness and start drinking, basically. So it's still quite relevant to the kids' lifestyles I see around here.
Yeah, but what about the Railway Children? I mean, isn't the Railway Children about three young terrorists who try to derail a train?
Yes. Also proves that even in a youth certificate film, Jenny Agutter will still find a way to take her pants off.
Probably in her contract.
Yes, it probably is. Any other news? Oh yes, we do have one other bit of news, don't we? I was confused by when I said it. Sorry, when I saw it. Apparently researchers have found a grasshopper stuck in a classic Van Gogh painting. Because he used to paint outdoors, he'd have insects landing on the canvas, and most of them would fly off, but apparently this grasshopper was unlucky and was destroyed by his brush.
Right.
Aren't grasshoppers quite big, though?
I'm not an entomologist, but it could have been a really little grasshopper.
Well, they've basically taken an image through a microscope, which shows the grasshopper embedded in the paint of the olive trees painting. And it's only part of the grasshopper that's been left there. It's basically been dismembered by the brush.
Right.
Which basically means that Van Gogh, in order to do that to the grasshopper, which, as you say, Andrew, is usually quite big, in order to do that, he must have been one hell of a violent painter.
Yes. Maybe that's what made him depressed, the guilt of being a grasshopper murderer.
Oh no, don't be silly, Graham. It was obviously the fact that he was haunted by the grasshopper's ghost. Like, he now possesses the painting.
Or maybe he just had that violent streak in him, but he couldn't go out and fight people, and he had to get rid of his violence through painting, but it just wasn't enough. It wasn't enough.
The grasshopper painting demands of more blood.
Possible episode title there, do we think?
Yeah. Because it's a lot better than what I said earlier about the Infinity Vajazzle. So, yeah, on that note, shall we take a break?
Let's take a break.
Let's go for it.
The world of comics and manga are much, much more complex than I'll ever know. So tune in to 4Panel on the Geek Show Podcast Network to make that whole world a little less intimidating.
and welcome back to the show. I've done my reading for this week, but Bob and Graham, you've both got books to review.
Indeed.
Yes.
So do that while I take a nap or something.
Okay.
You've earned this.
Yes, he has. So me up first, and I've actually got book two of the Apollonian Case Files by Mark A. Latham, which is called The Iscariot Sanction. Now, before I get into this, it's not absolutely necessary to read The Lazarus Gate before you read this, but it is advisable, because The Iscariot Sanction is a sequel that is kind of a prequel, but also set in an alternate universe, but this alternate universe was the one that threatened to overtake Victorian England in The Lazarus Gate.
Okie dokes.
So, yeah, it's kind of confusing to start off with.
Sorry, Rob, I think you might have cut out a bit there, because to me it sounded like you said a load of incomprehensible nonsense.
It was kind of that I said. You didn't cut out there, Andrew. But, yeah, anyway, it features John Hardwick again, and he is working for the agents of Apollo Lycia for the Crown and for Queen and Country and yada, yada, yada. But he is also joined by his sister Lillian, who is supposed to be dead but was very much alive in an alternate universe, blah, blah, blah. It's all kind of, yeah. Lillian is a very strong-willed woman, and she's satisfied being an agent of the Crown. She doesn't like her mother's attempts to make her settle down. And John is the same as he was in the first book. He is much more of a detective than he is a military officer. Very good at fitting the pieces of the puzzle together. This starts off, though, because this is told from the perspective of three people rather than one, whereas the first book was told more from the perspective of John Hardwick. This is actually told from the perspective of John Hardwick, Lillian Hardwick, and a third agent of the Crown, Sir Arthur Furnival. And the story starts with Lord de Montfort, who is visiting the artist, and the artist is a character that is introduced in The Lazarus Gate. He is kind of a psycho. You remember the painter, the comic book painter from Heroes?
Oh, yeah.
Right. He's kind of that. He paints pictures that tell the future, but he has these pets who are basically hideously deformed cats, and he feeds them meat, but I'm not going to tell you what that meat is, because I'm sure you can guess by the way I've said it. But the artist is called Sun Pen, and Lord de Montfort goes to see Sun Pen. And he's basically, they have their meeting, and then various things happen. While this is going on, a psychic called Kate Fox holds a seance, and that then causes something to happen, and the rift between worlds widens and causes this thing called the Awakening, which gives a lot of people these kind of intuitive powers. And against all of that, you have an ancient force, an old force, that is actually coming back to the fore. And they want to take back their power, the power that they gave up centuries, millennia ago. They want to take it back. And I'm not going to tell you what it is, but it's kind of generic who they are. You know, this mysterious dark power that the agents of Apollo Lycia have to fight against. But the interesting thing about this book is the fact that it's from three different perspectives. And Mark A. Latham has done a very good job of kind of balancing the perspectives so that they mesh. The story flows actually better than it does in the Lazarus Gate. This one actually does read a lot better than the Lazarus Gate. But the actual plot is kind of Fruit Loops. It is kind of, so there's this and it leads to this and it leads to this and it, sorry, you lost me at the sharp left turn. Right? And so you might find when you're reading this that you'll have to go back and reread what you've just read just to make sense of what you've read, which I found I was having to do several times. And that's not really a good thing when you have a book that is kind of plot heavy like this one is. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're having to go back and reread things just to make sure you understood what's going on, not a good sign.
No.
In general, though, I mean, the world that Mark A. Latham has constructed here of Victorian England and the alternate Victorian England, I like those worlds. I like the fact that they're joined together at the hip with this rift, but it does kind of remind me of Tsurani and Midkemia in Magician in Remedy Feist's works, although they weren't alternate realities. They were just two worlds joined at the hip by a rift. These are alternate realities, so you basically get things happening in the alternate universe that kind of mirror what's happening in the real world.
Mm.
On the whole, if you're a fan of the Lazarus Gate, you're going to find a lot that you enjoy in the Iscariot Sanction. It's just you need to be careful when you're reading it because it can be frustrating. It can be a little bit challenging. And at times it can be a bit forgetful about the fact that people who are reading this probably have read the Lazarus Gate.
Mm.
Because there are sections where it will insist on recapping certain events from the Lazarus Gate. And I'm like, well, I've already read the Lazarus Gate. I know this. You don't need to tell me in the middle of the bloody chapter.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's the Iscariot Sanction. It's a good sequel. It's not the best sequel, but it is a good sequel that is a prequel set in an alternate universe that's encroaching on our own universe.
Oh, sell it to me, Rob.
Oh, my God. It's people. The cat meat is people.
Is that a realisation or another excerpt from the Bad Sex Awards nominees?
That was the last thing I understood that Bob said was the artist who feeds his cat meat. I've made a Solvent Green reference so that I could contribute to the discussion.
That's fine.
Impressive. I would be very impressed to see you contribute something anywhere near as cogent and meaningful to this. A discussion of Joanna Karpovich's new book, Anubis.
Which sounds a lot more ominous than what it actually is.
Best one, yes, I think. Yeah. I've really been practicing my Anubis's yes. Over the... But
that's what this joke is.
Basically, yes, that's all of it.
Robin Grimm kept saying Anubis, and they wouldn't tell me why.
Well, it's because Anubis, it got me thinking of, you know, the Iranu and Uvavu from Shooting yes. Stars. And Grimm mentioned that when he went to see Doctor Strange with Sarah, she thought Dormammu sounded like that as well. We started going, Dormammu, Anubis!
And then applying
it to other gods like Jehovah.
Yes, Anubis. Karpovich is a comic book artist from Poland. I'm not familiar with the work. One is mentioned in the end notes called Postcards from Bialystok, which does sound rather good. But this is not a comic book. It's a collection of paintings she made where the motif running through them is that every one of them contains an image of the ancient Egyptian god of death, Anubis. Well, god of death is kind of the wrong way of putting it. We don't really have culture with an equivalent. He was the ferryman. He was like Charon in Greek myths.
Yeah.
And some of the paintings do depict him in this sort of scenario, but most of them depict him in a more incongruously modern scenario. I have to say, my favourite is the one that on paper is the most utterly ridiculous, which is Anubis and Happy Meal. Yes. Which is actually weirdly haunting, and I love the composition of it sort of mirrors his permanently upright dog's ears with the golden arches on the box. It's actually rather wonderful. The rest of them are much less bathetic. It's possible to find echoes of the early surrealists in paintings like, for example, Museum in Cairo, where, as well as Anubis and a statue of Anubis, there is also an unexplained woman in the shadows in rather the manner of those inexplicable sort of minor characters in paintings by Giorgio de Chirico or Paul Delvaux. There are some paintings of Anubis with children or with shiny red balloons that show a happier side to Anubis. Good to know that there's a bit of light and shade in Anubis's life, as well as a remarkable painting of Anubis with some lovely flamingos. But the overall mood of it is quite spare and melancholy, and there is no consistent through line, deliberately so I think, on how threatening or relatable you're meant to find Anubis. It has to be noted that some of the paintings are more overt tributes than others. the collection opens with a sort of version of Edward Hopper's famous painting Nighthawks, with Anubis as the only person in the Nighthawks diner, which I think is good. Hopper is obviously a ghost above this style of painting anyway. It would be hard to read it without thinking of Hopper's work. So it's nice that they acknowledge it. Later paintings that see Anubis in landscapes familiar from The Shining or Twin Peaks or Spirited Away, I felt were a bit too cute and made it feel too much like Karpovich was trying to prime you with what sort of story she saw Anubis inhabiting. I mean, to be honest, there is a profoundly Lynchian tint to the paintings anyway. One of the early ones, called Madame Isis, features Anubis outside a nightclub whose window features a red curtain, a tree branch, and an owl, which, you know, if I hadn't had it confirmed later on that she was a Twin Peaks fan, I could have sort of got it from there. But overall, I really enjoyed this. The end notes, which are by someone else whose name I'm not going to venture to pronounce because it's long and unbelievably Polish. Try
maybe, Graham, if you hadn't read so much science fiction, you'd be better at reading.
They try and make the case that this is some sort of hybrid form between comic book and other literature. But, you know, to me, it is a collection of paintings. It's a collection of paintings that suggest a narrative in that they all have one central character. But when you look at some of the painters that Karpovich seems to have been inspired by, like Max Ernst or René Magritte, they also had regular central characters who appeared in multiple paintings. So as a sort of groundbreaking new direction forward with a graphic novel, I'm not convinced it is a graphic novel, but as a collection of paintings, I found it atmospheric, memorable, charming, occasionally funny, and yes, thoroughly worth investing in. And that's Anubis by Joanna Karpovich.
I'm actually surprised you like that as much as you do, because when I first saw it, I thought, what is this?
It has this feeling of a sort of mystery object at first. You do think, as you say, what is this? But as it goes on, it just has its own tone. You know, it sets its own mood, and I like that.
Excellent.
I certainly thought it was a bunch of pictures of Anubis.
You can't deny that there are many pictures of Anubis. That's like the one objectively correct thing about this.
How did Mick describe it?
I can't remember. I didn't hear this.
He said it was something like the Instagram of the gods.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
I'd forgotten about that. Yeah. Anubis' Instagram feed.
On that note, we are at the end of the show. Literary Loitering is part of the Geek Show Podcast Network, so all of our shows are available on Apple Podcasts and iTunes and other podcast providers. We have a Patreon, which is available on our website and on Patreon. Just look for the Geek Show. If you're a regular listener, then show your support. We are also found on Facebook and Twitter, and you can email us direct. And you can email us direct, studio@thegeekshow.co.uk. That's about it from me. I have been Rob.
I've been Brent. Again!
Every time. We're having a standoff now.
It's basically like the ending of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
I'll be the bad.
I'll be Andrew. Snuck it in. I win.
And I'll be Brent.
We'll see you all for the last episode of the show.
Oh,
yes. Yep. So until next year, thanks for listening and keep on building those sexy, sexy assemblages.